All right. So yes, there is indeed an equivalent definition of monads. I gave a different one because I'm trying to emphasize the computation intuition, because I started from this semantics, operational semantics, and whole-by-value semantics, and I tried to motivate monads as type constructors. And I think it's easier to understand that this concept using that definition that I gave, because the star, which I used as is a lifting. So you have a map, a function which is a generalized function in a sense. So instead of taking this sort of morphism as functions, you consider this kind of morphisms as functions. And these functions are a generalized form of these functions. They might be what is called an effect. So the simplest effect was when T was this lifting construction for domains, and the effect was a divergence. So every function either returns the result, which is B, or diverges. And this lifting construction, it transformed this sort of functions to this sort of functions, and it makes functions composable, because if you take just this function and another function like this, then you cannot compose them. And of course, you want to compose the functions because you run one after another, and you need to tell what's the result of it, of the composition is. So, and apparently we use the star to have the composition, because if I have F and G, so now I can lift G using the star and compose it with F in a standard way. And of course, there is eta, which basically converts a normal function to this generalized function. So it's a function with a possible effect captured by a monad. I think for the programming intuition, it's a nicer definition. It's simpler. It captures this intuition, and it doesn't involve too many categorical notions. So I didn't even need to involve natural transformations to introduce it. Yeah, so we'll return to this later. And before I wanted to elaborate a bit on the material that I gave previously, a more elementary one, like products. So just do some simple things with them. And first of all, I need a definition of isomorphism. So isomorphism. So an isomorphism between two objects in a category is given by a pair of morphisms, well, AF from A to B and G from B to A, such that, okay, can I possibly express it as a diagram? So I start with A, so and then I apply F, and then I apply G, and I get this. And if I compose it with F, B, then I have the identity here. All right, so this is a way to express it as a diagram. You can instead just write down two equations, and these two equations would say that F is inverse to G. G is left inverse to F, and F is the, is right inverse to G. So, and one can also draw two separate diagrams. Yes?
You just take A and B and make IP arrows just go from the point to the point itself. And it's just
yeah. So you mean like this, F?
Yeah,
in this case it would work too. A, B. This kind of diagrams with loops, they are sometimes dangerous because sometimes not everything commutes. Yeah, so you could draw it as one diagram, you can draw it as two diagrams. Sometimes you cannot mix two diagrams into one. Sometimes you cannot draw a diagram at all. So I'm not a particularly keen on diagrams. There are just people who necessarily want to paint everything as a diagram and they feel disappointed if it doesn't work. I'm not disappointed. I think basically diagrams is just a pictorial language for equations. So you can always write down an equation as a diagram, but not necessarily the other way around. So if you don't want to write a diagram, you can always write an equation instead. All right, so example. In sets, an So in sets, isomorphisms are bijections. They are simple. That can be proven easily. And you can see the difference in sets. We are very easy about saying what is a bijection is. We don't need to give it a name. We don't need to say that it is an inverse, because if it's a bijection, then we can find the inverse and name it. So in categories, generally, you need to provide more data because you cannot truly discover G from F and so on. All right. So, and isomorphism, very important notion in categories, because basically if you have an isomorphism between two things, these two things are considered to be identical, having identical properties. So they may not be the same, but there is no, you usually don't want to distinguish them. For example, the products are defined up to isomorphism, which means that if you have two objects which are product of two other objects, these objects must be isomorphic. I wanted to show you a small table. I wanted to do it previously. Basically, a small dictionary, which is neither very formal nor complete. So we can basically compare the speech of set theorists, category theorists, and programmers of functional programming languages like Haskell. So in sets, we've got things like function. So now you see in categories, we do not have functions, that we have morphisms. Morphism. So, and in Haskell, we get program. Set object type singleton set terminal objects unit type. What else? Cartesian so Cartesian products. So in category they also call Cartesian products or just products. And here we've got product type. So, right, this is understood. And of course, it doesn't mean that we translate really without loss of information from one side to the other. We're just looking for the correspondence. And if you consider these left two columns, the first and second, this correspondence is not precise, because function is a very particular morphism. But if you compare the second and the third, then actually they are quite close to each other, this sort of notions. So Haskell provides a sufficiently precise way to talk about categories. Basically, you can imagine Haskell as a language to be a language of a certain complex category. Just a category has lots of properties, but you program and you reason about these programs in a way which is very, it can often be turned into categorical arguments. So there are, of course, things which do not have counterparts, like element. So it's not completely true that We cannot have elements in categories, but that's there is a way to define them, but they substantially different things. And I would recommend to think to better think that there is no notion of element at all, because that could be quite misleading. So the reason why I say that there are no notion of element is because element is precisely something that relates functions and sets. And in the sets as a category, this is not a big deal, and it's not noticeable because functions are just particular sort of sets. And in categories, sets, morphisms and objects are very different things. And basically, it's not conceptually correct to say that we that the element that we can have elements like we do have them in sets. So in the same story with predicates, for example. So what this indicates is that you cannot just take an arbitrary argument which you know about products, for example, in sets or some other concept, and convert it into an argument in category theory, because you can get into a trap, because certain things just don't exist. If your argument is about elements or about predicates, that's not just not gonna work in general, probably. So one has to take care of not applying set theoretic intuition when one reasons about generic categories, although it's sometimes very very difficult to do. Okay, now we've got morphisms, isomorphisms. In sets we've got bijections. And in categories we've got isomorphisms. And here I put a dash because you cannot quite formulate a notion of isomorphism. It just would be a pair of functions with certain properties, but in Haskell you cannot express these properties. Yeah, that's, by the way, what distinguishes the Haskell and categories, these two columns and categories. We are talking about things and properties of them, because we can draw diagrams. In Haskell, you can draw diagrams. If you formalize a monad in Haskell, which is done, then you just formalize the type of monad. So you also say that it's a type constructor, that it supports certain operations, but you can't say that these operations are subject to certain laws, because you can't write down axioms in Haskell. You just expect that if you instantiate a monad, then you, as a programmer, you would take care of the fact that what you instantiated actually was a monad. So you like verify your axioms with pen and paper. You wouldn't come up with an nonsensical instantiation. And this is a particular reason why this course makes sense, because if Haskell did everything for you, I would just give you as exercise writing down programs. But since Haskell cannot take care of everything, there is something to do for the people. Okay. This is all right. This is understood. So let's return to products again. So I would show you some very simple reasoning about about products. So for example, we can show that in any category with products, we've got this. So this is not part of my specification of products, but I can show that this is a derivable property. I think it's intuitively understood why this holds, because if I have a product and take first projection to second projection, then I pair this, then I recover the original object. So how I prove it very easily. I just draw an appropriate diagram. So A times B to B. And here I also consider A times B. All right, so this is my projections PR1 and PR2. And these are also PR1 and PR2. So when I draw such a diagram, I know that by definition of products, whenever I have this situation, there is a morphism and equal to the PR1, PR2, and this morphism is unique. But from the unique such this diagram, the resulting diagram commutes. But just as well, instead of this morphism, I could take the identity morphism. So if I take the identity morphism here, then here I would have a composition of PR1 with identity, and here also PR1, so this commutes trivially. And just as well, I would have a commutativity there. So if I use identity as a candidate for this morphism, so this morphism is also called mediating morphism, then I would get the same, but my definition says that this thing is unique. So if I found two things which make it commute, they must be equal. So therefore, this is a very very typical categorical argument, because in category theory, lots of things are specified this way by universal properties. So universal property is a property of the kind which we involve to define products. It's something is unique such that. And to prove equalities, and in category theory you always prove equalities, you just find two objects, or two morphisms with the same property, which are, but that property uniquely specifies the thing which is the subject to it, and hence you derive from it that these two things must be unique because they satisfy the same property, which is by assumption uniquely identifies what it is applied to. So similarly, we can prove that PR1, PR2 composed with, say, F is equal to, So F, G, H, F, H, G. So this this H distribute inside of the pair, and the proof is very similar again. So just use the same principle. So we can consider a diagram like this, A times B, A, now A and B, PR1, PR2. So here we've got C. So this was my F, this was my G, and here I've got FG. Right, this is all by the definition of products. And now suppose I've got some object D and my H goes like this. So I'm interested in this composition because this composition is on the left hand side of my identity. So I compose this arrow with this arrow, and therefore I can add one more arrow with the composition. And here I can just as well add yet another arrow, FH. Right, so this all still commutes. So, and now I can consider this outermost diagram, and it commutes because everything inside commutes. So, and I can use this diagram, apply the definition of products to this diagram, because again, I have got this product and these two arrows. So this morphism must be equal to the pair of this and that. But I have already another candidate for it. Right? So in the end, again, I have two candidates which make my diagram commute, and they must be equal. Okay. So it turns out that this properties that we have here. So there were two properties about projection of pairs, which were part of the definition of products, and there are these two more properties. So these identities, they completely specify products, and you can use them as an alternative definition of products. So how to do it better? So we consider three objects of a category with the following properties. Be such objects of a category that there are morphisms for any D. For any F and G from D to C. No, for any F from D to A and any G from D to B, there is a morphism FG from D to C. The following properties are satisfied. PR1 of FG is equal to F. PR2 of FG is equal to G. And then PR1, PR2 is equal to ID. And FG. H equal to F. H. G. H. Then so I do not mention any uniqueness properties anymore. So I don't say that certain diagrams commute. Okay, so these identities say that certain diagrams commute, but I don't say anymore that there is a unique morphism making a certain diagram commute. Instead of I just use a bunch of equations, and from these equations I can actually derive the fact that the structure is equivalent to products. Let's just try to prove it. So we don't have much to prove because basically I can already use these identities and I can draw them as a diagram. So here's AB and FG. So by these two equations, I know that this diagram commutes, but I don't know yet that this is the only morphism which makes it commute, because I didn't claim that. So suppose for some H, so let's just try to assume that there is another candidate which does the same job. So there is some H A B. Okay, I forgot the projections. PR1, PR2, PR1, PR2. Commutes. All right, so, and we will be done once we show that this H is equal to this pair, because this is the only thing which is missing. So once we show that this thing was uniquely defined, that by definition is a product. And how we show that they are they're equal, very easy. So I basically just transform this H. So this H is equal to ID times H. This is an axiom of a category. So maybe I just give the names all numbers to this axiom: 2, 3, 4. So now I can use 3 backwards, PR1, PR2, H. Then I can use 4 forwards. And this is equal to F G by my assumption, precisely because this composition is equal to F and this composition is equal to G. So therefore I get this equation. So these are, okay, what else I can say? So as I mentioned, the products are not defined uniquely. And the simplest way to see this So the simplest way to see this is to assume that we have some product. So if we assume that this is a product, then it's a trivial observation, of course. So these things are essentially the same, but formally they are different, and different in sets too, because here you got this certain order of pairs, and here you've got the same pairs but in a different order. So actually these are two different objects, but this doesn't matter because they are isomorphic. So the point is we can consider a morphism swap from A times B to B times A. Okay, I can use the indices A and B. I'm not explaining so far what this is, but the point is that you can parametrize a morphism with objects, like we did with the identity. Identity always carries an index, but we drop the index because we can recover it. So here I basically want a family of these maps, and I want to use it with A and B and with B and A. So I don't want to define the family, I just want to say that this is the principle. And if you want to distinguish them, you use different indices, but if you understand the indices, you just drop them. So, and then, what would be the meaning of this? PR2, PR1. So it does what it says. It swaps the components, and this is an isomorphism of these two things because, I mean, okay, so according to the definition of the isomorphism, abstract isomorphism, we need to provide two arrows in different directions, and compositions of them must be identity no matter from which end you start. So, and here, to give the arrow from this direction, you use essentially the same thing. How can we prove that this is an isomorphism? Well, we just can use the laws which we have discovered. So swap is equal to PR2 PR1 composed with PR2 PR1. So we can use this force law. So we get PR2, PR2, PR1, PR1, PR2, PR1. Okay. So this was my force law, and here I can use the first and the second laws to resolve this. So this will be PR1, PR2. And finally, there is the third law, which shows that this is identity. So note again that to show that something in isomorphism, we need to show two laws, that we compose the thing with the other one in one way around and the other way around. But this thing we compose with itself, so this both laws are just the same. So you don't need to verify twice. Okay, so I mentioned that that products are defined up to isomorphism. And here was the example of this. But in fact, it's very easy to show that it's true in general. Products are unique up to isomorphism. Let A times B PR1, PR2 be a product of AB and let A, let's say square, B, PR1 prime, PR2 prime is product, is another product. So we want to find out an isomorphism between them. How can we do it? So we just start drawing the diagram for this product, for example. A So I'm using the characteristic property of this coproduct, of this product. So since I have the maps, the other projection for another candidate for a product, there is this this morphism here, which is this pair PR1 prime, PR2 prime. And then again, I can add a times x once again on top of it, and again draw the PR1 and PR2 morphisms. And now I can use the characteristic property of this product. So there is another pair. Let me draw it with round brackets, because these are two different pairs. PR1, PR2. So that everything here computes. But now, as you see, we can again use the same trick, since this diagram, all this diagram commutes, it determines a unique map from AB to AB. And this map is this composition. But instead of this composition, I can also take the identity morphism, and it would also make this diagram commute, because we've got PR1, PR1, PR2, PR2. So if this was just identity, this would commute and this would commute just for the same reason. Hence, so PR1, PR2 composed with PR1 prime, PR2 prime is equal to identity. And I can call it F. And this can be called G. And by the same argument, it's easy to see that also G of F equal to ID. Hence, F and G So therefore, we obtained an isomorphism between these two objects. It's not that obvious from a set theoretic perspective that products are actually dual to coproducts. So coproducts over sets are disjoint unions. So we use the plus sign for them, and we have done something with them over sets and CPOs. But this is apparently a universal construction, just like products. And in categories, it's completely dual in the sense that, in a very formal sense, so we just turn the definition upside down by reversing the order of all the arrows, and we get this as a dual object to products. So let's give a formal definition. So an object together with two morphisms called injections is a coproduct of A and B if for any F from A to C and G from B to C, there is a unique morphisms a unique morphism FG from A plus B to C such that the following diagram commutes. So we've got what A to A plus B, B So everything is reversed, and these brackets are also called co-pairing brackets. So I don't know, this intuition, I think especially for programming, from the programming side, the intuition must be quite clear, because we've got like two functions from A to C and from B to C, and we form a function from A plus B to C, and this is This is a definition by case distinction. So like in Haskell, you've got this match expression, which matches the left-hand side, defines, calls this function the right-hand side, you call this other functions. So in Haskell, of course, you've got, you can have many cases, but essentially this is just iterated coproduct, where you also can name branches. So there are lots, some syntactic sugar added, but essentially it's this. Right, as I said, it's completely dual to products, and you see that it's dual. So I can mention an example. Again, in sets, so it's a sum is the disjoint union of A and B. So the fact that it's dual to product means that everything that we've seen about products applies to coproducts if you turn it upside down. For example, complete axiomatization for coproducts. So we consider a complete axiomatization for products. There were just these four axioms, which complete in the sense they determine products. And you can just take them and, as I said, dualize everything and get the corresponding system of axioms for coproducts. And you can also prove it, but the proof you obtain the same way, just turning everything in diverse order. So we've got like one. So if we inject to the left and compose it with the case distinction that we get, then we get F. If we compose with right injection, then we get right. So the product coproduct inner and inner is equal to ID, and there's this distributivity saying that H, F, H, G. So everything is mirrored. So, and as a more interesting exercise to that, I propose to consider an example. So I've mentioned the examples of monads last time, and we will consider one after another, one by one, because as you see, so the definition is pretty simple, but every example it's different, and it has it requires something particular to that to it. Now then we have products and coproducts. We can complete our stock of examples by considering monads over generic categories. because previously I just said, okay, we've got these examples, but they work over a fixed category. So like the lifting monad, it works over CPO, and there was this what list monad? Did I mention that list was a monad? Does anyone remember? No, you don't remember, or I didn't mention. So what examples did I mention? So that was the exception one, just one that I want to revisit, because I think I previously just said that that we do it over sets, right? Because we didn't know about. I couldn't appeal to this categorical understanding of coproducts, so I must have said that this is a monad over sets. But apparently, we can have consider it over any categories products. Exception monad. So in any category C with coproducts, T So this correspondence, which sends every x to x plus e, extends to a monad. What do I mean by extends to a monad? It means that there are the components of the monad, which should also be given because they are part of the definition. So I'm just going to give them right away. Under the following definitions. So eta x is nl. So it goes from x to x plus e. Right? This is precisely the type for nl. And f star equal to, so I'm imagine that f goes from x to y plus e. So here I would need to define a function from x plus e to y plus e. So I would need a case distinction. All right, I can use my pairs, copairs. So this side is y. If it's y, then I simply run my function f. And if it's the exception, then I return the exception. So, and I complete the typing. X plus E, where what? F goes from X to Y plus E. So these are essentially the Haskell definition, except that in Haskell, in that example that I shown you, we do not use inl and inner, because in Haskell you can name every constructor, and we also didn't use the copiers because there is this pattern matching construct which plays the same role. Let's just show that it's a monad. C So we need to prove certain things, like basically the three monad laws. So we have to prove that eta star is equal to id. Okay, how to prove it? Let's just take the definition. I replace this f by eta. Eta star is equal to eta inner. And then I use the definition for eta inner. Okay, and I'm using the my stored law. Nice, isn't it? So then we have got what f star eta equal to f. In order to show it, let's transform the left hand side. So this is going to be f inner composed. Yeah, sometimes I omit the circle. So the circle is a composition but in the categories, but it's too tedious to write it down every time, and it's often omitted when it's clear. But for clarity, sometimes use it, sometimes I drop it. So here we've got NL. Okay, and now I can use my first law, and I just arrive at F. And then finally, there is this law, f star g star equal to f star g star. Okay, let's consider it f star g star. This is equal to, so let's try to do it in one go. F inner composed with G inner. Does it make sense? Just leave it like this and transform the right-hand side. So the right-hand side is this, f inner. G inner. So now I use the distributivity, which is my force law. So I get f inner g f inner. And using the second law, this is equal to f inner g inner. So as you can see, these both sides are identical. So indeed, it is a monad, and we have pruned it over generic categories. So it works over sets, over CPUs, and over any funny possible categories, which we didn't consider here, as long as they have products, co-products. So how we proceed next? Okay. The next thing that I introduce is a notion called Kleisny category. Kleisny category. So Kleisny category have something to do with Kleisny triples, as the name suggests. Kleisny category. So it's Kleisny category is defined as follows. It's Kleisny category CT. So it has a name. So how we define a category? To define a category, we need to say what the objects are and what the morphisms are. So objects of CT are just objects of C, and homomorphisms of CT are homomorphisms of C, but of a different type. So that hopefully formalized that informal argument which I gave in the beginning of the lecture, that we can think of these functions from A to TB as generalized functions. So we've got some base category C, like sets, and we add a monad to it, and this monad generates a new category. And this is this is the reason why I said that even if you don't want to have other category, you will have them anyway, because monads generates a category. This is the way how it does it. So we say that the objects of this new category are the same objects as our original objects, but we change the notion of morphism. So instead of A and B as morphisms, we consider this morphisms A to TB. So now, at least with the case of exception, you can probably, hopefully, develop some intuition about these functions. These are functions which can raise exceptions. And this is the relation between the mathematical notion of function and the programming notion of function, because this is how we can cover a programmable notion of function, a function with an effect. And in this particular, in the particular case of exception monad, the effect is exception. So this function from this Kreisky category can raise an exception. And of course, the important thing is that we use the monad structure to complete this definition to a category, because the monad tells us that there is the unit morphism. And it so happens that this unit morphism has just the right type to make the identity of this extended category. And in the same way, you can use the Kreisky star to define the composition, because as I said, if you just consider these two functions, they don't compose, because these types do not match. And in order to match the types, you lift this function to TB, and then you can compose them. So you, by the lifting, you make this function exception aware. So it would be able to handle exceptions, because the Kreisky star provides a mechanism to that. And of course, it's not sufficient just to give this definition, because we need to check that this is actually a category. And incidentally, this has something to do with TB in the monad. Okay, what we have to do is to verify the laws of the category, which are just the three laws. So apparently, I just used the already this notation to prove it, because otherwise my identity in one category would clash with the notation for identity in another category. So I just using this eta in the first place. So we have to show that the composition of identity with a morphism is again this morphism, but my identity is eta and the composition is the classic composition. So I form this expression, and this is equal to F by one of the unit laws. And if I want to compose the other way around, then I okay, so this is equal to ID F, and this is equal to F. And in the other way around, you get this, and this is just equal to F directly by another monad law. And then finally, So if you want to prove associativity of composition, what you do is, okay, you compose, Kleissly compose, so you always add the star to the left component with GH, and you again add the star. And this is equal to, now this is just a normal composition in the line category, and I can use the associativity axiom for it. And now I can use a monad axiom, so which brings me this. And this is in fact the composition with the arranged brackets. Okay, unfortunately we didn't manage to cover the other definition of monads. So we'll do it next time. We also need to introduce natural transformations for that. Okay, this is it for today. Thank you.